tale as old as time.
It's a very long 10 seconds. There we go. I'm just saying. I have a story about that, too. Hey, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Welcome back, I hope, to Make Me Smart.
Welcome back, or welcome if you are joining us for the first time. I'm Molly Wood, and we are delighted to be with you because, as you know, none of us is as smart as all of us.
That is the rule. So we're going to climb right into the Make Me Smart portion of this broadcast today, podcast, because it's totally fascinating. Molly did all the hard work on this, on the interview, as you'll hear, and I'm going to sit back and learn. Here's the deal. Big hearings this week on Capitol Hill. Not Brett Kavanaugh, thank you very much, although that is big. The Senate Intel Committee is having a hearing tomorrow, Wednesday, at which Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, and Jack Dorsey, the Twitter CEO, and some as yet unnamed player from Google, which is a whole long story, will appear to talk about collusion and influence on the 2016 elections. And then also later, actually, Jack Dorsey is going to be grilled by Republicans on Capitol Hill on how he decides what goes on that platform, because what happens on those platforms is not an accident. Molly Wood, go.
Yeah, it's not 100% an accident. And so some of this was inflamed. The hearings, you know, had already been scheduled, but of course were inflamed by a presidential tweet, as so many things are, on August 28th, in which he said Google search results for Trump News shows only the viewing and reporting of fake news media. In other words, they have it rigged for me and others so that almost all stories and news is sick, bad. Fake CNN is prominent. Republican, conservative, and fair media is shut out. Illegal? Question mark. And so this has reignited this conversation about the algorithms and methods by which news is served. And it's a little bit of a tricky conversation to have because he may not have things straight about algorithms, but he does have a point about filter bubbles, which is something that as far back as 2011 was the title of a book and TED Talk by Eli Pariser.
Well, I was just going to say, maybe you ought to define filter bubble, right?
Yeah,
or are you
totally
getting there? You're getting there? Okay.
The idea of a filter bubble is that because these sites, and Google in particular at the time was what this was all about, what they want to serve you is what they have determined to be relevant information. And that can be tailored based on your location, your personal information, things you have clicked on in the past, and what are determined by a sort of series of secret algorithmic criteria to be trustworthy sources. So it is 100% true that when I Google something and I am logged into Google, I might get slightly different results from what someone else might get.
Right.
And as far back as 2011, people were calling for Google to make an ethical commitment to presenting diverse viewpoints over this pure idea of relevance, mostly because we don't know how those determinations are being made. It's all super secret. And they operate now increasingly on artificial intelligence, which, as we know, can be very biased. So basically, we wanted to hear an argument for this idea, the conversation about whether there is bias, how much potential there is for it, and how much it impacts our discourse. So we wanted to hear some arguments about this idea, to have a conversation about, you know, to what extent there is bias or the potential for it in platforms and how it actually manifests. So we talked to Kathy O'Neill. She's a mathematician. She's the author of a book called Weapons of Math Destruction. See what she did there? And it turns out that Kathy had a very similar reaction to mine. She's actually writing an article that says something along the lines of like why Donald Trump is wrong about the algorithm, but right about the filter. So I talked to her on Friday and we started our conversation right there.
Well, he's really wrong about which way the bias is landing, but he's not wrong that there is bias. There just is. And he has nailed a sore spot in this whole debate that the tech giants would love to keep under wraps. The big tech companies, and it's not just Google, right? It's all the companies that use algorithms to sort through information and to serve us up news. There's always a bias. I want to be completely, like, let's clarify, you know, there is bias and then there's political bias. And I think they think that the bias that exists is not political. And that's wrong. But I think it stems from like a sincere, like earnest hope on their part that because they don't have intention of political bias, then there is no political bias. I just feel like they really should have learned their lessons by now. We've seen biases. They keep popping up. Like, we've seen false news coming up from Google. You know, my example was from a couple years ago when I searched for, you know, did the Hull, H-O-L, it auto-completed mm-hmm. to, did the Holocaust really happen? And then if I pressed return, which was the expected thing for me to do, like many of the top 10 hits were Holocaust denial sites. So that's not exactly politics, but it's certainly conspiracy theory and wrong. And when it was pointed out to them, like they just did an ad hoc fix and they were like, nothing to see here. But at the same time, there was like a, you know, a commercial on the Super Bowl where they had a man like reading a story to his little girl. And I'm in the middle of it. She says, what does a blue whale sound like, Daddy? Because the blue whale's in the story. And the guy's like, mm-hmm. hey, okay, Google, what does a blue whale sound like? And, you know, you hear the sound of a blue whale. So I'm just like, you know, Google can't have it both ways. They can't ask us to trust them. They can't ask us to have our six-year-old daughters trust Google, but also say, oh, that Holocaust denial website that we promoted, that wasn't us. And I feel like that's the basic tension that Google and others are continuing to live under. They want to have no responsibility, no accountability for all sorts of trash that comes up and all sorts of bias. It's not just misinformation. It's also like if you know, famously, if you search for professional hair or unprofessional hair, I should say, just millions and millions of pictures of black women showed up. It's like, you know, deeply biased. Now, that's not intentional on Google's part, right? It was probably in large part the tags that humans put on their own pictures. But it is what people find in terms of information. And it's not objective fact. And it does end up hurting people.
Well, and I feel like it's, you know, it's interesting. There is a tension in even having the conversation, right? Because before President Trump comes out and says, there's a bias on Google against me, the tech industry is having a whole conversation about filter bubbles. And, you know, all these smart tech analysts are saying filter bubbles are real. They, you know, we are all living in some version of the Truman Show. And then as soon as it's an accusation like this, then everybody wants to back away from that conversation because you don't want to, you know, it's like, how do we avoid feeding the idea that the news can't be trusted in a time when a nuanced conversation is really hard to have?
And I think the reason they're avoiding it so intensely is because they don't have an answer for it. They just don't have a solution mm-hmm. for it. I mean, one of the things that really got on my nerves when Zuckerberg was called before Congress to discuss some of these issues is that his answers basically came down to saying, we're going to use artificial intelligence to solve this problem. Well, guess what? Artificial intelligence is what caused this problem. And if you smart guys had, you know, were so good at AI, then you would have already solved this problem. But there is actually no AI solution to this problem. So that's just not going to fly. I mean, I would argue, a waste of time to actually call these guys in front of Congress because they simply don't have the answer. It's not within their business model to solve this problem.
What happens then, you know, when they come, they're going to come before Congress this week at the time we're taping this. This will go up on Tuesday, so a couple days mm-hmm. later. What happens when, you know, representatives from these companies come before Congress? They undoubtedly give unsatisfying answers. We all still know that bias exists. You know, is there anywhere for this conversation to go? Because it seems sort of clear that there is no answer, really, that bias is always going to be a part of software because people write software.
It's not just that people write software. It's the data itself that creates the bias as well. But yes, you're right. Partly it's the people who write the software. Well, I think there's like best case scenario, which is pretty bad. And then there's worst case scenario, which is much, much worse. The best case scenario for me is the tech guys, the CEOs and CTOs and et cetera of these companies admit it. They come clean and say, yeah, we don't know how to solve this problem. There's real bias. We can monitor it. We can learn how to manage it. And maybe we can use some combination of AI and crowdsourcing and paid editors to mitigate it. But it's really a hard problem. And we can't promise anything is going to be solved in the next couple of years. I mean, that would be an honest answer. I don't expect that to happen. What I do expect to happen is like a lot more cagey dodging of of these issues, sort of trying to explain computer science to Congress people just to intimidate them. And then like a slow but gradual escalation of just nihilistic doubt by the public. What can they trust? If they're being served up by secret algorithms, stuff that they can't trust, if videos and audios, tapings can't be trusted, if everything could be fudged, if reality itself, if facts aren't facts, you know what I mean? Like, where does it end? And, you know, I don't think that we have an answer to that. Let me put it that way. I have three sons and, you know, I ask them, how do they know what to trust? And they don't. And I don't even know how to give them trust. You know, but like, by the way, like, it's not a new problem that we don't know who to trust. Like, trust is an old problem. But I would say that one thing we had that we don't have anymore is like some people to complain about when they're giving us bad information. Like, we knew who to complain about. In the current day, we have just an algorithm and nobody seems to be accountable for its mistakes. And that doesn't seem sustainable to me.
So what does that solution look like? Because certainly, I mean, it sounds like you said, there's always been a question about what is true and what's not true. And everybody's always had a stake in making you think the truth is not the truth for whatever reason, political, you know, monetary, religious. Does it come down to the sheer size of these platforms and the influence that they have? And that's why it's so much worse?
Well, it comes down to that as well as the way it, because it's commercially motivated. And, you know, Facebook's optimizing of engagement and Google's selling ads and all the gaming that happens to get your search results up to the top. You know, there's enough known about these algorithms that people have tried everything and figured out how to get seen more, how to get more attention. And the very people who get the most attention are the people that probably don't deserve that attention and are like fear mongers and conspiracy theorists and et cetera. So it's gameable. It's a bad system. Like, I think we could design it better. And I think, but I don't think that will happen automatically. That will happen very intentionally and with like a lot of infrastructure of monitors and, you know, lots of disagreements about what does it mean to have a conservative bias? Like, we haven't sorted that out, right? And in order to automate any kind of system to monitor for this, we actually have to have that conversation, another conversation we're trying to avoid. This is going to be a mess, is the long story short. And that's a best case scenario if we actually admit what our problem is. Worst case scenario, we're going to just not admit it and things are just going to get less and less clear and people won't know what to trust.
And then is there, just to go all the way to the dark place, Kathy, is there a worst case scenario in which some kind of regulation comes into play of the speech censoring variety?
Well, just to be clear, I don't think regulation is, you know, only comes in the very worst possible case scenario, right?
Oh, I don't think so either. But I guess I mean the type that we're talking about now, where it's sort of like we're going to take a look at how these search results get delivered, and you know, there's maybe regulation that could help, and then there's the scary kind.
Oh, totally. I mean, you don't want the government to decide what's true and only allow that kind of thing to be shown. I think we're a long way from that. I don't think we're that far away from a lack of faith, though, in what we're seeing. I think undermining our faith, our trust in information itself is easier, actually, and closer to us than a sort of full-scale like control of the media itself.
Right. I guess the last question I have is, would that scenario return us to a little bit of how we originally felt about the internet? I mean, I feel like when the web first came along, it was like, you can't, you know, nobody is who they say they are. You can't trust anybody. You shouldn't trust anything you read online. And then we all sort of gradually just became incredibly more credulous. Like, would it help us a little bit to return to that sort of overall skepticism?
Wow. Like, I have to say, like, I was much more optimistic back then. back then we really were anonymous. And now the very people who need anonymity the most are the ones that are like sized up and sussed out. You know, they're the ones who everybody knows, every marketer on the web knows their gender, their race, their zip code, their buying power, et cetera. and decides what they deserve accordingly. And the people who are actually have an anonymity are the ones that are tricky and malicious. So I think it's like, if we could go back 20 years, let's do it. I wish.
Oh, man. Anybody remember that Far Side cartoon from like 20 years ago where Gary Larson drew a lot of cows like and all this jazz? And one of them was, on the internet, nobody knows you're a cow, right?
Yes.
Nobody knows you're a dog, right? That's kind of the way it was. Yeah. Boy, there was a lot in there. That was good stuff. There was a lot in there.
What would you have asked? It's always hard when I hate doing an interview by myself because I'm like, what would Kai say?
Yeah, no. This was in your wheelhouse, and I think you were the person to do this interview. I was struck by two things. One is the thing that she said about these companies want it both ways, right? Google and all the rest of them. They want no responsibility, but they want us to trust them, you know?
Totally.
And we have to figure that one out. And the other thing, the note I literally wrote was, wait. She said it's not within their business model to solve these problems. And and maybe they ought to rethink their business model, right? Because that which cannot continue forever won't, and this can't continue forever.
Well, it can't continue without, you know, the worst case scenario that we sort of laid out, which is do you get broken up, which we're going to talk a little bit about in the news fix vis-a-vis Google. Because, it's sort of you don't get to so far in American society, like the reason for antitrust law, right, is you don't get to just sort of like make money and ruin things forever. There's some point where either you tip over due to competition, who capitalizes on the mistakes that you're making by being so sort of, you know, evil and unaware of your impact, or you get regulated.
Yeah, but however, there's no First Amendment right to John D. Rockefeller selling oil at $11 gazillion a barrel in 1905. But there is a First Amendment right of free speech. And yes, I know, private company. I know. Right. But that's where this whole thing gets mixed up. Right.
Yeah, that's it really does. And it really gets mixed up. And we'll talk about that a little bit in a minute. Also, with this idea of like algorithm versus bias and how those things sneak in there. Yeah. And it's a very, as you heard, it's a very tricky conversation to have.
Yeah. Super big shout out here, and I hope I pronounce his name right. Bita Makarek, she suggested we speak to Kathy on the show. She gave us a little suggestion on our Facebook page, obviously a listener, which gets to the point of none of us is as smart as all of us, because without that little suggestion, we would never have found Kathy, and we would not have had that conversation. So,
And she was fantastic. Yeah. And her article, by the way, will be up by the time this episode comes out at Bloomberg. We'll have a link in our show notes. And please keep those great ideas coming. Tell us if you're aware of your own online filter bubbles, if you have ever heard that term, if you worry about it, how you combat it. Email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org.
One more thing about filter bubbles. Wait, can I just say this? And I'm 1,000% sure I've said this on this podcast before, right? Filter bubbles predate social media and the internet, you know? I mean, if you only read the Wall Street Journal editorial page, you're in a filter bubble, whether you know it and accept it or not. And that's important to recognize.
Or if you used to get all your information from a crow that came from, you know, like the king, the castle. I'm just saying, like filter bubbles and the control of information is, not to go all Beauty and the Beast again.
No, Game of Thrones. You went crow. You got to stay with Game of Thrones.
But it's a tale as old as time. But yes, I mean, information control is everything. It's everything.
Winter's coming. You know nothing, Jon Snow. I'm on Twitter at Kai Rizdahl. She's at Molly Wood. Hit us up. We'll talk more after the break. Here you go.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
And we're back.
New music.
I know. Look at the beat drop.
Beat drop. Listen to you.
So dubstep.
I just spilled my coffee all over the microphone.
That's what happened to me, by the way.
God.
We're back, and it's time for our news fix.
All right, you go first, just because.
There's a bunch of news to get caught up on about these hearings, but I'm not going to lie. There's only one piece of news that I care about vis-a-vis these hearings, and it is the fact that Google is probably not going to be there at all.
Crazy.
And the sheer poor decision-making that I think that represents. To update you, Google's CEO, Larry Page, was invited to testify as part of these hearings with Facebook and Twitter, declined, asked if instead the company could send their chief legal counsel, who has already appeared before the Intelligence Committee. They said no, and that is likely to result in an empty chair. And that's just huge deal. It's a huge deal when Google has escaped so much scrutiny, and that is about to stop.
I think it's a huge shooting of oneself in one's own foot. Honestly, honestly,
I really do. You're starting to see this increase. We've done versions of this story on both Marketplace and Marketplace Tech, the Wither Google story, because unquestionably Google is a huge participant in the spreading of all kinds of information, mis and otherwise. And for them not to answer for it is really, it's astonishing. And it gives the impression that Facebook is doing more. Like, Facebook gets to now come out of this and say, hey, man, we took an earnings hit. You know, we reduced our own margins by hiring all of these people to try to deal with this. You know, they appear to be the company that, in good faith, is actually trying to improve itself. And Google is the one that's just trying to hide, just stay out of the conversation completely. And that is not going to fly.
So do you think they just don't get it? Google?
You know, it's funny because we keep saying this and it comes down to that question, like, do they think it's worse to go on the record?
Right.
And I guess they do. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, they're not under oath. I don't know.
Well,
I just think it's very surprising.
I think they will be. Won't they be?
Are they on the Intelligence Committee?
I don't know.
I'm not really sure. There was a lot of back and forth about that during the last hearings. Like, did Mark Zuckerberg say under oath? And then people on Twitter were like, he's not under oath, dummy.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. And welcome to the internet.
Yes, exactly. Welcome to the internet, which is kind of where I'm going. So you think back to what Kathy was saying about let's go back 20 years and we were all less trusting and on the internet, nobody knows you're a cow. That was my line.
Yep.
I was watching, and this is not my original idea. Some folks out there in the commentariat, as it were, thought of this, but I think it's completely right. I was watching John McCain's funeral on the weekend. And the eulogies and all of this and all of that and the bipartisanship and it was touching and moving and worthy. But I just want to make sure, since I get to go on my own little toot here for the next 45 seconds, it's important to me that we not falsely romanticize what things were like before the present era. Because if you think about the Bush presidency, he started a war in the Middle East that continues to destabilize the region today and plays a huge part in our daily life and the lives of our military. Barack Obama, tougher and more restrictive on the press and more prosecutive of the press than any president before or since. It's important not to falsely romanticize a lot of things. The internet, way back when, is one. And what things were like before this present moment. I don't know what the future deals with, but let's be clear-eyed about the past. That's it. That's all I got. Quickie. Somber. Sorry. Sorry.
Have you watched that? It's going to feel like age tangent, but it's not.
All right.
The new Jack Ryan series on Amazon Prime?
No. You know, I was going to, but for whatever reason, I haven't yet. But I'm a big Jack Ryan, Tom Clancy fan. I was back in the beginning.
I know. Me too.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to. It's awesome.
Oh, is it really?
Awesome. I binged it's only 8 episodes to my great disappointment, but that's great because I only have limited time to binge, and I binged the whole thing over the 3-day weekend. But there was one point where I sent a text to my brother and I said, I think that this entire storyline is basically just a searing indictment of Obama era drone policy and how, you know, it just rained anonymous death from above and radicalized as many people as it saved, right. if not more.
Another great example. Another great example. Got to be clear out about the past. Totally true.
And it is perfect with this algorithm conversation, too, because the point is nuance.
Yep.
Always.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Which we lack in our discourse today.
Yep.
We just do.
Which is why we have this podcast, by the way, because we're trying to be better.
Quick news update. Rahm Emanuel, who was on this podcast, a year ago, plus or minus? We went to Chicago and spent an hour with him and had what was a really good and fun conversation. He announced today, Tuesday, that he is not going to run for re-election, which is a big, big deal in the city of Chicago. And so
it is a huge deal.
I commend to you that interview that Molly and I did a year ago.
I agree. Please go listen again, because what's striking about it is that You hear Rahm Emanuel. It's episode 16, by the way, from May of 2017, in case you're like scrolling through your list. I Googled it because
that's not true. Google? No.
In fact, I was just about to say I DuckDuckGo'd it because, as regular listeners to this podcast will know, I don't use the Goog. What's remarkable to me is that, you know, part of our reason for wanting to interview him was the sort of rise in power of cities and states and how in polarized times that's going to be the almost certain outcome. And he describes being the mayor of Chicago and being the mayor of a city as almost like the highest and best purpose for a politician and the best way to have this like really incredible immediate impact. And I hate to even feel that by deciding not to run, when he said he was going to run and raise a bunch of money, that he's giving up on Chicago.
Yeah.
But I hate it. I wonder, I don't know. I'm really curious to hear what's going to happen next. And I'm going to listen to that later today as well.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, I think. Right? Are we moving on? I'm moving on.
Yep.
You moving on? All right. Your turn. Here we go.
Dear Make Me Smart.
This is Jess from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
I'm David Stork of Portola Valley, California.
I'm a doctoral candidate.
I'm getting married this November.
I work for a Fortune 500 company.
All right, so we're going to start by going back to a conversation that I had. I think Molly was out a couple of 3 weeks ago about Civil, the blockchain-based journalism organization that is starting up, trying to get going, has attracted several newsrooms. Business model still a little bit in doubt if you listen to that interview. It goes back to that. It goes back to a conversation that we had about Alex Jones. And it also goes back to this idea that we talked about a little bit in this podcast of platforms and their responsibility. The question comes from Josh Raha in Massachusetts, and here he is.
Your guest suggested a couple of times that a platform like Civil takes the decisions about what gets published and who gets left off the platform out of the hands of, quote, big tech. But Civil has no more right to make those decisions than Facebook or Twitter. In fact, if they succeed, they'll be accurately described as big tech themselves. This looks no different from any other self-publishing platform, where we use the power of the internet to disaggregate news and amplify voices that don't otherwise get heard. I couldn't help but think of your previous episode when listening to this interview. The Alex Jones problem you discussed then isn't solved by Civil. This is just another place where he could pop up.
All of that is true. All of that is true. I guess two thoughts. One, and this is actually something that I thought of in the interview that you did with Kathy, that the thing that's not being talked about a lot here is the responsibility of readers and viewers to exercise a little bit of critical thinking. That's it. You know? I mean, no? You're not buying that? Okay.
I'm buying it. I think that's a skill that's going to have to be taught.
Well, yeah.
But it's funny because it's part of why it is a good thing that Google prioritizes, Google and Facebook and sites like them are trying to prioritize trustworthiness, come up with a way to measure trustworthiness so that, because here's the thing, we, you know, on Marketplace Tech, we talked to Sanan Aral, who is an MIT researcher who wrote a piece about fake news and found that, did a whole research study about fake news and how it spreads across the internet and found that it really works. Like, the thing about false information and fake news and propaganda is that it's highly effective and it spreads farther, faster, and deeper than real information. So not only are we not good at critical thinking, we don't even want to. Like, most people don't want to.
No, that's true, right? Because it's hard work. And you and I have had this conversation before, and that's totally true. One more and yes, I grant your point. One more thing about this question from Josh about who decides, right, what shows up on a platform. That, I think, is the thing we're grappling with, right? Because, as you pointed out, a lot of these decisions about what shows up are being made algorithmically. And yes, humans write algorithms, but also AI. And mm-hmm. so it becomes less and less controllable, which I think is a big deal.
It's fair to note, too, that with Civil, I think part of their deal is that if you own the token, that you can vote,
yeah,
right? Like that, you know. there will be some way to vote or report yeah. information that is violating various ethical values. But there's no question that our commenter is correct. Josh is correct in saying that any decentralized platform can become a vector for basically any information.
Yeah.
And that's not inherently a bad thing. It's just how much we're able to access it and compare it to other information and understand where it's coming from and why.
I feel unresolved about this.
About the Civil part or all of the...
Well, about all of it.
Yeah.
About the who decides and about the, you know...
Yeah.
Whatever.
I feel like that's a wise place to be, actually, Kai. Like, we don't have any answers.
Yep.
This is all really new to us.
Yep.
And by us, I mean the world. Like, it's only like,
all of
you know, we keep saying that, but it's only, this is the only phenomenon that's 10 or 20 years old. The speed and power of propaganda spreading.
And you still have to tell your 11-year-old to wash his hair in the shower, right?
I mean, seriously. So right. specifically.
Totally.
All right, moving on. Last week's show, we asked you about the business case for reforming capitalism, which I think is going to be very interesting to keep pursuing. Many people wrote in, including Drew McGrath. I'm going to read a little from his email. Quote, if we're really talking about a business case for ending capitalism, we need to look at redefining what business is, incorporating environmental impact, social well-being, and altruism as an element of the economy, or redefining economy if necessary. Which I like. I do want to make one quick clarification, though. What? I'm not saying we didn't need to end capitalism.
Right.
Like, I got some tweets about that, too, of course. Reform. This is a right. reform conversation.
Right. Right. And let's be emphatic here. It's about the business case for reforming capitalism. It's not
yes.
make big companies give back more of the profits to the workers. I mean, maybe that's part of it. But that's not the whole answer, as a lot of people on the left side of the spectrum say. That can't yep. be the full answer. Just cannot be.
Nope. Because capitalism works.
Yeah, totally. Maybe not well for everybody, as we know. But anyway, we got this question from Marion. She asks also over email, if big companies set wages at the top, here's the question. Do the lowest paid factory workers across the brands these companies own see the same wages? If yes, the argument for a high impact of large companies on wage growth is underscored. If not, then the argument is lessened. Thoughts? Close parentheses. Actually, close quotes. The answer is I don't know, right? Because no company is going to pay the same wages to everybody across the spectrum, right? But large companies do have an impact on what workers writ large make because there are so many workers in those large companies. That's where mm-hmm. I am.
And we also have a listener answer to the Make Me Smart question, our favorite thing. McLeod Andrews has apparently been trying to think of his answer ever since we started the show.
That's a long
the
time.
The question, of course, is, I know, I love that. Like, that is commitment, wow. buddy. Thanks for hanging with us. The question, of course, what's something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? And he finally came up with his answer, and here it is.
I used to think that things could be completed, that there was a final state in which they wanted to be. Like when I would tour college campuses with my dad or discover a new city as a kid, I would see construction and I would feel this sense of that I wasn't getting the real campus. I wasn't seeing the real city because, oh, it's under construction. It's not done yet. And that would frustrate me. I still am coming to grips with it, but that things are not ever complete. Everything we see around us is actually in process, is a process. And that is actually the truth of what's around us. Like, there is no perfect.
Well, holy crud.
I know, it's amazing. Wow.
I don't even know what to say.
I'm pretty gobsmacked. That's fantastic.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Yep.
Pretty
Life good. Is a journey.
So here's the question one more time. What is something you thought you knew but then found out you were wrong about? Let's see if you can come up with something as good as McLeod did. How about that?
Mm-hmm. And then we'll give you some music like you got.
Clearly I'm wasting my life. I don't even know what I'm doing.
No, you're not. Your life is a journey. That's the whole point. Make me smart. At marketplace.org is the place to send us those recordings and all of your thoughts, which we look forward to reading. And thanks to everybody who has already emailed us.
Yes.
Keep them coming. Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. Our senior producer is Eve Troe. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez.
Our theme music was composed by that very same Daniel Ramirez. Also, Ben Tolliday, the executive director of On Demand around these parts, is Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. That's sort of a gobsmacking answer to that question, right?
Yeah, right? I just, like, want to sit with that one. And I love that it took him a year or so to come up with it, because right, it's worthy.
Yeah, you know, it's rivaled only or rivals the one from Norman Lear, which, just to remind everybody, was I didn't think I had it in me to kill somebody.
God. Yep.
All right. We got to go.
Amazing.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.